The night may be long and the dark may be deep, but the answers are there to be found. Whether it's the normal, the abnormal, or the paranormal, you're in the right place. Let's go Beyond Reality.
Good evening, good morning, welcome everyone. It is Beyond Reality Radio. I'm JV Johnson. Thanks for being here tonight as we kick off another week of great programs. It's always a pleasure to have you along, and it's an honor to have all the radio stations along that carry this program and send it out to millions of people every night. So thank you, stations who have become part of the Beyond Reality Radio affiliate list. By the way, if you're looking for that list because you want to find a station in your area that carries the program, just go to beyondrealityradio.com. The list is there. You'll also find the Beyond Reality Radio coffee mug, and if you haven't gotten one of those, there are dozens of people that have, and they claim, and these are their words, okay? They claim coffee has never tasted better, or tea, or hot chocolate, or whatever you, soup, for that matter. The Beyond Reality Radio coffee mug is available for sale right on the website. Also, check us out at Facebook at Beyond Reality Radio, and I'd invite you to come along and join my Facebook page as well. Give it a like, a follow, whatever you do these days. I'm not even sure. There's follow, there's like, there's pretend. I don't even know. But it's JV Johnson on Facebook, or it's also JVJ Paranormal. I'm not sure why there's two, but you can get to it either way. So a lot of great stuff going on. We appreciate you being here. Tonight, we're going to be talking about many interesting things that have been written by author Tim Schwartz. He's written about what he's calling the eighth wonder of the world, Geff the Talking Mongoose. Now, this is a very interesting story. Don't let that quick title make you think it's strange, or it is strange, but it's not worth listening to because it's a fascinating story. So we'll be talking about that. Plus, Tim has written about Nikola Tesla. And that's always a great topic of interest here on the program. So we'll talk about that some. And time travel. So we've got a trio of great topics with our guest, Tim Schwartz, tonight. We will take your phone calls later in the program at 844-687-7669. We enjoy doing that. So we'll make a point of getting some of those calls in. What'd you think of I can't say the word because it's a trademark or copyrighted word, whatever. But what did you think of the big game yesterday? Well, if you're from New England, I bet you're pretty darn happy. And being in Cooperstown, New York, I'm close enough to New England that I wasn't jumping on board the Patriots haters. I felt as though it was pretty cool to see Tom Brady at his age and his level of success become I think he's now been a winner in a Super Bowl more than any other. He was tied for first. Now he's sole owner of that record in first place, 6 victories. Is that right? Do I have my numbers correct? It wasn't a particularly exciting game, was it? It was kind of but it was a good game. It was a defensive game. And if you look at it that way, and it was actually pretty exciting to see both of those defenses be so effective against such high power offenses. So it was a pretty cool game for that respect. Have you also noticed that the commercials have gotten kind of meh? You know, for so many years, these build up to these Super Bowl commercials have been what everybody's talked about. And last year, and particularly this year, there really wasn't much. I mean, there was a couple okay ones, whatever. But it seemed obvious that they were de-emphasizing the commercial component. They still were running commercials, obviously, but they weren't touting them as, being anything spectacular. And they truly weren't anything spectacular. So, I don't know, we'll see how that goes. They kind of ebb and flow because you build up expectations year after year after year. And someone in the chat room commented that there was a lot of robots and AI themes throughout the commercials. That's true. I did notice that. They'll downplay it for a couple of years and they'll come back. Of course, as media changes, who knows how it's going to work. I did have an opportunity. My son, who we've talked about on the program before, is actually going to school in Holland, and he was able to pay-per-view the game and watched it and FaceTimed me while I was watching it. So we kind of got to watch it together. It was kind of cool. Although, and they would have started at midnight for him and ran to 3 in the morning, 4 in the morning, whatever it was. Anyway, so we have, like I said, a great program coming up tonight. I do want to remind you that we've got some pretty neat events coming up as well. In fact, on February 12th, what is that? That's going to be a week from Thursday. Rebecca Foster makes the trip to upstate New York, and she and I are going to B-Side Ballroom and Supper Club in Oneonta, New York, to do a gallery reading. She's going to do the gallery reading. I'm going to host it. The tickets are almost sold out, but I do know there are some available still because I went over the seating chart today. So if you have any interest in that, go to B-Side Ballroom. I think it's bsideballroom.com, but either way, just Google it and you'll find it, and you can grab yourself a ticket or two to be part of the gallery reading. It's the first time Rebecca's appeared at something like this. And then after that, she and I travel to Edmonton, Alberta in Canada, and we do a an event there called Dead by Con. And I know it's a bit of an odd name, but it's a horror fan convention. There'll be a lot of horror movie celebrities there, plus Rebecca and I will be there. She'll be conducting readings at her table throughout the weekend, plus you know, signing autographs, so we both will, enjoying that. So that's going to be a great weekend, and that is, of course, the 15th, 16th, and 17th. It's called Dead by Con. You can get more information about that event by going to deadbycon.ca for Canada. So I think I got all that stuff taken care of. You know, Mondays into Tuesday night and morning is always a bit challenging trying to remember what we have to talk about, but I think we got all that stuff handled. Okay, so we're going to take a break, and when we come back, we will bring our guest Tim Swartz in, and we will start this conversation about Geth, the talking mongoose, who is the eighth, or was anyway, the eighth wonder of the world. It's Beyond Reality Radio. Did you know that online retailers like Amazon have constant deals that can save you money on the things you buy every day? It's no joke. Save 40%, 50%, even 80% on great products, and all you have to do is know about them. Noodle Shark is the way to be alerted when something good is coming your way. Noodle Shark is the social media page that lists great deals that not only save you money, but give you the deals before anyone else has them. All you have to do is find Noodle Shark on Facebook. Search it as The Noodle Shark. That's The Noodle Shark, because you deserve to save too. Become a shark and save. I forgot to mention, we've got some very interesting programs coming up the rest of the week, too. In fact, we've got actually what would be considered kind of a best of. I hate to use that word because that's what sometimes we use when we bring a recorded program on, but it's not going to be recorded. It's all live, but it's some of our best guests. We've got John Potash joining us. He's an author and documentarian. That'll be tomorrow night in the first hour. He was on, gosh, I don't know, maybe about a year ago, talking about his book called Drugs as Weapons Against Us, the CIA War on Musicians and Activists. Well, he's made it into a documentary, and he's going to be talking about that. And the second hour of the program, Rhonda and Dwight Hull, they're paranormal researchers, psychic mediums. They'll be talking about their new book called Conversations with Spirits of the Southwest, a continued journey into the paranormal. And that'll be in the second hour of tomorrow night's program. Wednesday, Dr. Knowledge. He's been on the program a few times, and he's always a fascinating guy to talk to. His real name is Charles Reichblum, and he'll be on talking about his book called Fascinating Facts. It's actually the all-time book of fascinating facts. That's Wednesday night's program. Then, of course, Thursday is the first Thursday of February. You know what that means. Our guest will be Rebecca Foster, who I just mentioned is going to be at a gallery reading in Oneonta, New York, and then at Dead by Con in Edmonton, Canada. But she'll be on the program Thursday night taking your phone calls. The phone lines, they light up like crazy. It's like a Christmas tree when she's on. They almost melt down the system. So if you're at all inclined to get a reading from Rebecca on Thursday night when she's on the program, get your dialing fingers ready, because it's tough to get through, but that's just the nature of it anyway. But tonight we have an awesome program as well. Tim Swartz is an author. We're going to be talking about several of his books, and I want to welcome Tim to the program. Tim, it's great to have you on Beyond Reality Radio.
Why, thank you, Jason. It's a pleasure to be with you tonight. It's
actually JV. Jason's not with us tonight.
Oh, hi, JV.
So you, first of all, I want to mention your website is called conspiracyjournal.com. You've gotten many books to your credit, including The Lost Journals of Nikola Tesla, America's Strange and Supernatural History, Time Travel Fact, Not Fiction, and is it Geth or Jeff the Talking Mongoose?
It's Jeff.
Jeff the Talking Mongoose, okay.
Yeah.
And the eighth wonder of the world. Now, see, obviously, you've written about a lot of very varied topics, all strange, all interesting. Where'd you get your start in all this?
Oh, my gosh. Well, like a lot of people who are into, you know, the weird and paranormal, I got to start at a fairly young age, though I was kind of actually drug into it, kicking and screaming. About third grade, I was given an assignment from the newspaper to do an oral presentation in front of the class about flying saucers. Flying saucers were, they were in the news and the headlines at the time. I knew nothing about flying saucers, could have cared less. You know, I'm an Indiana boy. You know, I was interested in, you know, car racing, the Indianapolis 500, stuff like that. So, you know, I gave my presentation, and that was it. I was pegged by everybody as the flying saucer guy. I was the guy who believed in Martians, little green men, things like that. You know, that was the end of me. But what ended up being fascinating to me was that, you know, when people would go and make fun of you in front of, you know, everybody else, they would later come back by themselves and say, you know, I don't believe in that kind of stuff, but... And then they proceed to tell me a story about how, you know, say their house was haunted, or when they were on vacation, their family saw a UFO, something like that.
Yeah, you know, and it's funny. It's funny you mentioned that, because one of the things that I always joke about when we talk about our work, you know, invested in ghosts, ghost hunting, that kind of thing, is frequently we'll have people come up to us when we're at an event and say, you know, I don't believe in that stuff, but let me tell you what happened when I was 8 years old. You know, my grandfather appeared magically at my bed. He'd been dead for three, you know, that kind of thing. Everybody seems to have a story, yet some of people just won't accept what they saw as real.
Yes, exactly. And, you know, I mean, we don't, you know, currently, at least as far as I know, you know, we don't have... you know, a ghost in a jar in a laboratory, or right. You know, a UFO. Well, supposedly, yeah. We don't have a UFO in a hangar someplace. All we have are the stories from these people, and that's what drew me in. You know, were these absolutely fascinating stories by people who wanted some kind of explanation. You know, they wanted to be able to tell their story and not be made fun of. You know, not be, you know, told, oh, yeah, you're crazy. You know, that sort of thing.
A lot of people are concerned about that. A lot of people don't want to tell the story for fear of ridicule. I think that's changed a little bit over the last maybe 10 years or so. What do you think? It's starting to change.
It really has. And a lot of that, I think, has to do with, you know, reality television.
Right.
And the predominance of, you know, so many ghost hunting shows and UFO shows. Bigfoot, especially, is popular right now. So a lot of that stuff is just, you know, right there on, you know, a person's frontal cortex. But, you know, it used to be that most people, with the exception of, you know, people like you and me, had no idea about this kind of stuff. And so when they would have an unusual experience, they didn't have any place in their brain to categorize it. You know, I mean, we go through life, and our daily experiences, our brain has this, you know, has various locations on how to categorize them. You know, stop at the red light, go to work, open your, you know, open the files on your computer, that sort of thing. You don't have a little file for a circular craft landed in front of me and little gray guys with big eyes got out and kidnapped me. You know. So when people have this kind of unusual experience, naturally, they're either going to think they're crazy, ignore it completely, or just actually just freak out.
Or all of the above at times. So you started writing about, or started, you know, as the UFO guy, you kind of got that label. But obviously, you didn't stay the UFO guy. You might be doing UFO stuff, but you branched out.
Oh, well, I was always, you know, after it started with UFOs, I mean, I then became fascinated by the subject because of all the different things that people were coming and telling me. So I wanted to know more. And, you know, at that time, you know, you were able to go to the drugstore and buy a relatively inexpensive paperback book, you know, 50 cents or so, on practically any kind of weird paranormal subject. You know, Brad Steiger used to put out these absolutely fantastic little books that just, you know, each chapter would be a different kind of paranormal or unusual story. And you know, I mean, I got to know Brad really well years later, and I kind of based my own types of research on the stuff that Brad was doing as well. And so, you know, I mean, all of it to me is fascinating, and oddly enough, a lot of this stuff seems to have some kind of unusual connectedness. You know, I mean, there have been people who have seen Bigfoot in areas where there's been a lot of UFO sightings. They, you know, oddly enough, there's also an odd connection between hauntings and UFO sightings. So, you know, you start looking into one subject, and then pretty soon it just opens up the floodgates, and everything comes pouring in.
Well, I think there's a, you know, it's the same curiosity that'll make you interested in exploring and looking for UFO evidence is going to be there when somebody mentions Bigfoot, or somebody mentions ghosts, or somebody mentions, you know, one of the many other cryptids of other kind. You know, that same curiosity, if it's in you, it's going to be in you for almost everything.
Oh, yeah, definitely. Though, you know, it is funny. There are a lot of researchers who have focused on one discipline. Say they study nothing but Bigfoot, Sasquatch sightings, or, you know, UFOs or whatever, and they can become really insulted if you mention cases where, you know, Bigfoots have been seen around UFO hotspots or things like that. And I think that some people have just kind of tunnel visioned themselves into, you know, this is what it is, and there are no variations one way or the other. And I try to be just the opposite, you know, because you know, maybe it's just that odd bend that I have in my own brain. I just see all of these connections with all of this stuff that, you know, you would label paranormal.
But, Tim, what is conspiracyjournal.com? What do you got going on there?
Well, Conspiracy Journal, it's kind of an aggregate site. We put it together with my publisher, Timothy Green Beckley. And it's just a site where all of us who write for Global Communications, you know, it gives us a place to put our work up, advertise our books, things like that.
And there's a lot there for folks to check out. So let's move on to your book called Geoff the Talking Mongoose, The Eighth Wonder, or Geoff the Talking Mongoose, The Eighth Wonder of the World. What is the story of Geoff the Talking Mongoose?
This is just an absolutely fascinating story. And, you know, I think that a lot of people who have been into researching the paranormal may be familiar with the case. But, you know, there's a lot of people who aren't, which is just a shame. And that's one of the reasons that I wanted to write this book, was to reintroduce this absolutely fascinating story that took place in the 1930s. On the Isle of Man, which is an island in the Irish Sea in between Ireland and England. And it involved a family named the Irvings. There was James or Jim Irving, his wife Margaret, and started out their 12-year-old daughter, Vori. Now, the Irvings were actually transplants from England. Jim had been a salesman for a piano organ company in Canada, and had been a very successful salesman at that. He was well traveled, well educated. They all were, but because of World War I, sales fell out, and he was starting to get along in age, And they decided, his wife Margaret had family that that lived on Man, and one time while they were visiting, Jim found out that there was a farm for sale. Its name was Dorlish Cajun, or Cajun's Gap in the English term. And he decided that this would be a good place to invest his money. He had the idea that he was going to be a gentleman farmer, you know, somebody who had hired hands that would actually do all the work, and he would just collect all the profits. So he went and bought the farm, and decided that they would eventually move there. But he spent some time actually renovating the place. It had been built probably, they think, in the 19th century, though there is some evidence that it may be a lot older than that. It was a large farm in comparison to others in the on the island. And in the process of renovating the interior of this place, he put up wooden paneling as insulation on the inside that left about a 4-inch air gap between the stone wall and the wood paneling. Now, this will be significant later on in the story. At the time, they had two almost grown children that spent a few years with their parents on this farm, but then moved out, moved back to England, and started families of their own. About the time that their oldest children moved away, Margaret found herself pregnant, and they had a Vory. Which, you know, that's at this point they were already in their 50s. So by the time that Jeff made his appearance, Jim was already in his 60s, and Margaret was following up not too far behind. So in 1931, Jim claimed that they started hearing something unusual in the walls of their house. At first, he thought that rats or some other kind of vermin had gotten inside. So he set up traps, poison, things like that. Nothing seemed to work. Out of frustration, he said, he barked at it like a dog. And whatever it was that was crawling around in this 4-inch gap barked back. And that's how it started. They would make noises at it, and it would repeat the noises back. And then after a while, they noticed that it was making sounds, they said, similar to a baby when it's trying to learn how to talk, you know, baby-type noises. And, you know, you would think that somebody would be like, okay, that's it, I'm out of here.
Yeah.
You know, back up and move. Unfortunately, they did not have the ability to do that because the farm was not doing well, and they, you know, they were there to stay. But their daughter, Vory, became fascinated by what was going on, and she started repeating nursery rhymes, and this voice would repeat back. Voice wasn't exactly what you would call a normal human voice. I likened it now to like Alvin and the Chipmunks type of voice. Very, they said it's very high pitched, almost like a squeal. But it talked in identifiable words, and it progressed from there. It stopped not. It no longer just mimicked or parroted the words back, but it also showed an intelligence. It would form words and sentences on its own, and it just it was like an avalanche. Once it started doing that, they couldn't shut it up. It talked incessantly. And eventually, it claimed that it was a mongoose that had been brought to the island in the early 1900s by a local farmer by the name of Irvine, I think is what he said it was. And this farmer had bought a bunch of mongoose from India and had them shipped over to and released in order to take care of the rabbit population, which at that point, I guess, had gone crazy. The odd thing about that story is that Jim Irving was later able to find out from a local newspaper that this had actually happened, that a local farmer had bought a bunch of mongoose and let them go. But this voice claimed that it was a physical creature, that it was a mongoose, that it wasn't a ghost, because naturally the Irvings, they thought that they were being haunted.
I would think that would be their first, you know, thought. I don't know where people's minds go if you have a voice mysteriously speaking from behind the wall, but I mean, that would probably be the top of my list, thinking, wow, is this some kind of spirit or something?
And that's exactly it. You know, I mean, in the early 1930s, there was a new interest in psychic phenomena and paranormal abilities, and a lot of this had to do with World War One. There were still a lot of people who were alive that remember and had, you know, relatives who died in World War One, and there was a big offshoot of psychic mediums and trying to talk to, say, like relatives who had passed away during the war.
Right.
So they were very familiar with the idea of ghosts and hauntings, and naturally they thought that this was a ghost. Jeff said that he wasn't. And they actually, every now and then, would catch a glimpse of something, say, running past the doorway or across the beams in the ceiling. Vori was the one who managed to get better looks of it. She said it was about 12 inches long. It was yellowish in color and had a long, kind of like fluffy tail. Well, the description almost sounds like a small, you know, say like a red squirrel in North America.
Right.
But now he said that he was a mongoose and was an actual physical creature. Now I should say also that its story would vary from time to time. It claimed that at one point that he was a, I'm trying to remember exactly how to say it, that he was he was a spirit of a man in the shape of a weasel, and that he was going to haunt them with the sound of rattling chains. He also claimed that he was the eighth wonder of the world. That's where I got the subtitle for my book. The voice was extremely boastful, verbose, and also it loved to curse, especially at the very beginning. I suppose, kind of like a child who's just learning their way in the world. It would curse like a sailor. It had an extremely bad temper, and in fact, the Irvings moved their daughter into their bedroom at one point, which really outraged Jeff. And, you know, he would yell and scream and create like a poltergeist-type activity, and said that, told him that he would find Vori no matter where they moved her. And they were extremely frightened at first. But things calmed down after a while. They moved Vori back into her room, and then it kind of became, you know, almost a you put quotation marks around this, a normal situation, except that they had something weird in their house that was talking to them all.
So how much time passed from when they first started to hear the noises to the point where this creature, if it was in fact a mongoose, was actually having full-on conversations with these folks?
Less than a year.
Oh, wow.
It was that quick of a situation. And, you know, Jim Irving actually kept a diary, so to speak, of day-to-day activities of what Jeff was doing. And it's, you know, it's everything that Jeff would do, it increased exponentially. You know, it started to make noises. A few days later, it started to form, you know, kind of like gurgling baby-like sounds. A few weeks later, it started to mimic words back. And it just grew from there to the point where they couldn't shut him up.
It's one thing to have a talking mongoose in your wall. It's another thing to have one that just won't be quiet. Tim, as the Irvings were experiencing this behavior, did they have other people, third parties, if you will, come in and experience it as well in the lead up to all of this? I mean, just as it was getting started?
Yes, there were others that claimed that that they heard Jeff. One of them specifically was a family friend by the name of make sure that I get his get his name right here. Well, first of all, okay. There was a gentleman who whose name was Captain James Dennis, who had been sent over to the Irvings by the paranormal investigator from England, Harry Price. Price wasn't able at first to go to the island to investigate himself, so he sent his friend Captain Dennis. So now, when Dennis first went there, Jeff refused to talk, refused to make a peep, squeak, wouldn't do anything. However, he did produce some interesting poltergeist activity. He threw things at Captain Dennis.
When you say he, Tim, you're talking about Jeff the mongoose was doing this. This activity. Okay.
Right. Well, okay. And again, you have to realize that.
I just want to make sure it wasn't Jim Irving that was doing that. This was Jeff.
No. This was Jeff. Jeff produced all kinds of interesting poltergeist type of activity. He moved furniture around. He threw rocks and stones and packing needles. He would allegedly pee from cracks in the wall and from the ceiling, other really supernatural types of incidents rather than something that you would expect from
Irvings experienced that type of activity prior to the arrival of this paranormal investigator?
Oh, yes.
Oh, they had. So the poltergeist type activity had preceded the arrival of this investigator. It didn't happen.
Definitely.
Yeah,
definitely.
Okay. I just want to warn you, we've only got about a minute and a half here before we have to go to our next break. Did the Irvings send for this paranormal investigator? How did this Harry Price and his colleague hear about the activity to the point where they felt it was worth that trip?
The Irving story actually had been picked up by not only local newspapers, but international papers as well. So, England had become very familiar with the Irvings from papers like, say, like the Daily Mail and places like that.
Were you able to, in your research for the book, able to find some of those articles?
Oh, yes. Not only have I found articles, but I also have found writings from both the Irvings and Harry Price and other investigators that are now being kept at various libraries.
So when Mr. Dennis got to the island and started his investigations, you said at first Jeff wouldn't do anything. We've got about a minute here before we have to jump into the break. But then poltergeist-type activity started. Was that – did the Irvings and Mr. Dennis feel as though that was because Jeff was getting angry?
Well, Jeff told the Irvings that he would not talk to anybody who didn't believe in him. And according to Jeff, nobody believed in him. So when a lot of these people would show up, Jeff refused to talk. But now on subsequent visits, Dennis did hear Jeff talk and actually caught brief glimpses of him.
Did he certify that he believed that this was, in fact, whether it was mongoose or not, obviously he couldn't be certain, but that it was something actually in the wall that was talking to them?
Yes. Captain Dennis did confirm this with Harry Price, that he believed that there was something unusual going on that farm.
Interesting. Okay, we're talking with Tim Swartz. By the way, his website is conspiracyjournal.com. TimHartman.com. Pay that website a visit. Check out all of Tim's work, his books, and everything else he has on the website. We're going to take our break here. When we come back, we'll continue our conversation. Plus, we'll take your phone calls and questions at 844-687-7669. It's Beyond Reality Radio. Please support the program. Go to patreon.com/Johaw. That's J-O-H-A-W. Thank you for joining me tonight. It is a Monday/Tuesday, and we are starting the week off right. Just to give you a preview of what's coming up the next few nights on Beyond Reality Radio, of course, always great guests. And in the coming days, we actually have a number of returning guests with us. John Potash will be with us. He's an author and a documentarian. We'll be talking about his newly released film, which is based on his book of the same title called Drugs as Weapons Against Us, The CIA War on Musicians and Activists. Now, of course, we all know names like Jimi Hendrix, John Lennon, Kurt Cobain, and others. Were these cultural leaders, I'll call them, musicians, were they targeted by the CIA, and were the drugs that were apparently involved in their deaths, some of them we know about, some of them we may not, were they some type of murder weapon? Well, we'll talk to John Potash about that in the first hour of tomorrow night's program. The second hour, Rhonda and Dwight Hull will be with us. They are paranormal researchers and psychic mediums. We'll be talking about their new book called Conversations with Spirits of the Southwest, A Continued Journey into the Paranormal. And then Wednesday night, Dr. Knowledge has been on the show a couple times. Always a great time. His real name is Charles Reichblum. We'll be talking about his book called The All-Time Book of Fascinating Facts. Some really cool stuff when we have a conversation with Charles. And then Thursday night, it'll be the first Thursday of February. Therefore, Rebecca Foster will be with us to do her psychic readings. So she'll invite your phone calls, and all night long we'll take calls, we'll do readings. And Rebecca will be here throughout the whole program Thursday night. She'll also be with me on February 12th in Oneonta, New York. That's in upstate New York, at the B-Side Ballroom and Supper Club for a gallery reading. And if you're interested in that, if you're anywhere in the upstate New York area, check out the website, the B-Side Ballroom and Supper Club, and see what's going on, because there's a few tickets left from what I understand. And then for the weekend, what are the dates of the weekend? 15th, 16th, and 17th, Rebecca and I will be at a convention called Dead by Con. A little bit of a weird name, but it is a horror film fan convention in Edmonton, Alberta. And it'll be happening all weekend long. And the website is deadbycon, B-Y for by, con, .ca for Canada. Whole bunch of celebrities going to be there from pretty cool movies. And Rebecca and I will be there. So if you are in Canada, and I know it's a big place, but if you can get yourself to Edmonton, do that, because we'd love to see you. Tonight we're talking with Tim Swartz about a number of his books. Particularly, we started the conversation about The Eighth Wonder of the World, or as we like to call him, Jeff the Talking Mongoose. Tim, again, thanks for being here. I wanted to ask you before we got back into this story here, though. You've got a lot of books, have written about a lot of topics. How many books to your credit right now?
Oh, my gosh.
Too many to count, huh? Too many to count.
I have, more than 10, I'll put it that way.
Yeah. Well, it's quite an eclectic body of work covering a lot of different topics. Again, I invite people to go to conspiracyjournal.com to check out the list of titles. So as we're talking about Jeff, the Talking Mongoose, and the Irving family, whose home Jeff inhabited, just so I understand here, other than catching glimpses, you know, maybe running through the ceiling rafters or here and there just kind of catching a tail or something along those lines, did they ever really get a good, straight-on, full-eye view of Jeff?
I suppose the closest that anybody ever got was around 1935. Vorey was able to catch a series of photographs of Jeff using a camera that was provided to her by Harry Price. Jeff agreed that he would jump up on the gate that led up to the property, and that Vorey would take pictures of him, but he told her that she would have to be on alert and do it really fast because he wasn't going to hang around for long. So, you know, according to Vori, he would just, like, appear out of the hedge and just run across the fence, and she would snap a picture. Most of the pictures that she took, nothing came out. But there were about four or five photographs, which I've included in the book, where something is seen. Now, the, you know, skeptics and debunkers say that it looks like that maybe, you know, she took a stuffed toy or, you know, maybe, you know, a fur from her mom or even as far as, you know, the skin pelt from a rabbit and posed it on these, you know, on the fence. But, you know, that's probably about the best evidence that we have when it comes to, you know, like photographs or things like that.
Well, what about Captain Dennis or Harry Price as paranormal investigators? And I know that recording devices were not, you know, very common in the early 30s. Cameras were a little more common, but not super common either. But did they get, were they professional investigators enough that they would have carried recording equipment? And did they, if they did, did they capture anything?
The closest that anybody had at that time would have been a dictaphone, which was a fairly large instrument, and the nicer ones would have required electricity, which the Irvings, their farm had no electricity, no running, you know, no radio, nothing like that. There was a type of dictaphone that used wax cylinders,
right,
that you could actually just manually turn it.
That's right.
And one of the investigators actually, you know, brought one out to the farm, but like a lot of poltergeist cases, it refused to work. And this, you know, again, this was a manual one. It required that you crank it, and then, you know, whomever was talking would speak into almost like a gramophone type of
like a big horn, yeah, kind of a big horn.
Right.
They were talking to
Jeff was talking, but the device would not operate. It was like it was frozen in place.
I imagine that would have been difficult to catch any audio anyway, since it was kind of non-directional audio. If it was coming out of the wall, that would have been very, very difficult. You know, it's hard to imagine the day when quote unquote paranormal investigators were going into the field without any kind of electronic devices at all. And that's kind of what they were dealing with.
You know, it's frustrating when you investigate a case like this, because you see so many opportunities that were lost in trying to do a proper investigation of this case. I mean, for instance, Jim Irving was basically the spokesperson for the entire family. There are some quotes from his wife, Margaret, who apparently had a lot of conversations with Jeff and actually even touched him a couple of times. But nobody really took the time to sit down with her and interview her for any long periods. The same with Vori. Jim Irving kept Vori at a distance from the male investigators. He was very suspicious of anybody that wanted to talk to her in private. There's actually a picture of Jim and Vori and a gentleman by the name of Robert Lampert, who co-wrote the book The Haunting of Cashin's Gap with Harry Price. They're sitting on a bench, and Jim is sitting like right in between, almost like a chaperone.
Now, did the Irvings profit from any of this?
No, not at all. Not at all.
So you'd have to say there really wasn't a profit motivation if there was some kind of hoax going on.
No, the Harry Price, when he published the book, The Haunting of Cashin Gap, which sold very poorly. It sold like maybe 400 copies at the most, and then was, you know, was, there was never a second printing. he sent the Irvings a check for like 10 pounds, and that was it.
Jeez.
Yeah.
And, well, I mean, so, do you think that the Irvings expected it to be a successful book, and therefore they would have expected to profit and just didn't?
No, I don't think so. Jim Irving often said that, you know, he didn't want to accept, because, I mean, there were instances where, you know, like some of these newspapers offered to pay money, you know, to come and talk to them. And Irving always refused it because he thought that it would actually sully their reputation and, you know, convince debunkers that everything was a hoax.
They didn't charge admission or have people come in and tour the home or any of that stuff, right?
No.
Yeah.
Nothing like that.
We're talking with Tim Schwartz. We're talking about Jeff the Talking Mongoose. And, Tim, what was the final disposition here? And how many years did this go on, and how did this story kind of come to an end?
The case started around 1931, and according to Vorey, Jeff was last seen around 1938 or 1939, so, you know, almost 10 years for now. You know, I mean, if you're familiar with any kind of poltergeist activity, you know, it lasts really just a brief period of time. So Jeff had a lot of stamina to him, a lot of energy. You know, it's very frustrating because after Harry Price published his book in 1936, all information coming from the Irvings just dried up. We really, with the exception of Dr. Nandor Fordor, who was a parapsychologist and associate of Sigmund Freud, visited the farm in 1936 and came back with a few new stories, but after that, all information just disappeared. Now, in 1970, a journalist by the name of Walter McGraw actually tracked Vorey down in England. She was 52 years old at the time, and he was able to convince her to talk to him. And she claimed that everything that was written about Jeff, all the reports, were true, that there was something in their house that talked, whether it was an actual little animal or a ghost, poltergeist, familiar, you know, what have you. She said that it all actually happened and that nobody had faked it. She said that she actually wished it had never happened, because she said it basically ruined her life.
Wow.
She never got married because she was afraid that if, you know, a potential suitor found out that she was that girl, you know, involved with Jeff the Talking Mongoose, that would be it. And so, I mean, we're left with Jeff kind of arrived with a bang, but then just faded away.
So in all your research and everything that you did to put the book together, you probably looked into this more than anybody has. What are your opinions, or what were the opinions of those who might have you know, direct access to the knowledge of what Jeff the Talking Mongoose actually was? Was it truly a mongoose that could talk? Was it an alien? Was it interdimensional? Was it a mongoose that was harboring the spirit of somebody else? What do you think it was?
Well, and of course, now, you know, I mean, my opinion on the matter means nothing, but I definitely don't think that this was an actual physical creature that, you know, somehow had gained the power to speak. I mean, there's just too many paranormal type elements to this story to lead me to believe that this was just, and, you know, just with the quotation marks around it, you know, an extra clever little mongoose that somehow had learned
right,
to talk.
Right.
But now, you know, I mean, you could speculate, you know, endlessly. I mean, you know, the Isle of Man has a rich tradition of, you know, like fairies and brownies and hobs, and a lot of the stuff that that Jeff did really harkens back to these old stories of house spirits, you know, elemental types of creatures that would live in a house and would take care of the family as long as the family fed and took care of it, which the Irvings did. Jeff liked to eat like bacon and chocolate and things like that. But if you got it mad, then you know it. it would not be very polite.
Jeff made a few threats along the way, didn't he?
Oh yeah, yeah. I mean, he was constantly threatening people. He threatened the Irvings. He, you know, anybody who would come to visit that he didn't like, and he didn't like very many people. He would tell them that he would follow them back to where they came from and puncture their tires or kill their livestock. You know, things like that. You know, most of the time these were just empty threats. Though a couple of times he claimed that he, you know, like killed poultry at, you know, neighboring farms that that didn't believe the Irving story.
I have to assume, we've got about a minute here, I have to assume that when the investigations were done and they were hearing the voice of Jeff, they were also monitoring the whereabouts of the family members at the time.
Yes. The majority of the time that they would hear the voice, that everybody would be nearby. There were times where Vori would actually be away from the house, you know, out taking care of chickens, yet Jeff continued to talk. Now, the odd thing is that after Vori moved to England in 1939 to work as a wartime machinist, Jeff stopped talking, but the poltergeist activity continued in the house.
Oh, it did. Okay. His website is conspiracyjournal.com. He's written many books, including the book we've been talking about, Jeff the Talking Mongoose, The Eighth Wonder of the World. He's also written Time Travel, Fact, Not Fiction, America's Strange and Supernatural History, and The Lost Journals of Nikola Tesla. A lot of great stuff there, Tim. And I'd love to continue talking about Jeff the Talking Mongoose, but I really wanted to touch on a couple of these other topics that you've written about as well, particularly Nikola Tesla. Tell us about The Lost Journals of Nikola Tesla.
Oh, sure. Well, this was a book that I had published in the year 2000. And this basically dealt with Tesla's extensive collection of papers, notes, what have you, that mysteriously disappeared after he passed away. Tesla, you know, of course, was the person that developed the AC motor and our modern-day electrical system. He also had this dream of being able to send electricity wirelessly. He also developed, at the time, what he called a death beam, or death ray. The newspapers called it a death ray, but Tesla always corrected him, said it was a death beam, that there was a difference between a beam and a ray, and that we now know that essentially it was a particle beam weapon, what we now call a particle beam weapon. But after Tesla passed away, the United States government became very interested in what Tesla had. Unfortunately, they had ignored him in the last years of his life, but after he died, the FBI, along with the Office of Alien Property, came in and took everything that they could find, took them to a warehouse to be examined. And the odd thing about this is that one of the people that they had come in and go through all of this material was a gentleman from MIT by the name of John Trump, who was the paternal uncle of now President Trump. So a lot of this material ended up disappearing after the Office of Alien Properties took a hold of it. Some of it we know ended up at Wright-Patterson Air Force Base. Others ended up with DARPA and various other facilities. And then a lot ended up in the hands of the Soviet Union because Tesla was born in what is now would be Croatia. And so Yugoslavia actually petitioned the United States for a number of years to get a hold of this material, and it eventually ended up at the Tesla Museum in Belgrade.
We, you know, many of us who are familiar with the story of Tesla know about the death beam, know about his vision for wireless electricity transmission. And, you know, he was working on a lot of projects simultaneously. And if these journals held the key to a lot of these ideas and they were taken, have we seen any of these technologies be introduced elsewhere that may have been the result of those journals being taken from Tesla's home?
Now, one of the interesting things is that in 1980, the Aviation Week in Space Technology published a U.S. satellite reconnaissance photo of a suspected Soviet beam weapon installation. Researchers who examined this photograph couldn't help but notice that it bore a striking resemblance to Tesla's diagrams, or at least the ones that have been made available to the rest of us and haven't been scrolled away somewhere. Tesla in 1936 actually sold a number of his research papers to the Soviet Union through an armed company that was located in the United States. Obviously, the Soviets were pretty happy with what they got, because a couple of years later, they actually paid Tesla another, I think it was around $25,000. And noted that the material that they had, that he had provided them was working properly. Unfortunately, that's all we know about what the Soviets may have been doing, with the exception of some unusual reports, especially from the 1960s, from places like Iran that bordered the then Soviet Union, that seemed to show some kind of unusual weapons testing taking place. Now, I know for sure that the United States was working on Tesla material, because I worked at a television station in Dayton, Ohio, in the early 1980s, and one of our beats was Wright-Patterson Air Force Base. So one day I was there with a reporter, and the press liaison was, looking through the files, trying to see if there was, something of interest that we could do a story on. I mean, we'd do a story like every couple of weeks from Wright-Patterson. And this lieutenant made this kind of offhand remark saying that, we've got, we're doing some research on that mad scientist Nikola Tesla, but I really can't talk about that now. And then he went on to something else. And that's how I got interested in Tesla to begin with. So years later, I think 2013, the FBI released a bunch of their documents about Tesla, and in these documents was a letter around the same time that I was in Dayton from a this was from a general at Wright-Patterson asking the FBI if they had any more material from Tesla that they would like to have it. And of course, the FBI wrote back and said, well, we never had any material that was taken by the Office of Alien Property. So and of course I have to remind you that this was the time that Reagan had started the whole Strategic Space Defense Initiative, or Star Wars, as the press called it. So there was a scramble from all sorts of different places, research facilities in the country, looking for ways to develop space-based, especially, energy or particle beam type weapons.
Some people say that the Tesla's concept of wireless electricity transmission could have or would have been realized had it not been for maybe some corporate interests that would that killed the idea. Did you come across any of that, and do you believe it to be true?
Oh, definitely. Tesla first developed this concept. He had built a laboratory out of Colorado Springs, Colorado. He went out there at first to see if there was any way that that he could harness lightning from thunderstorms. But while he was out there, he developed the idea of Earth resonance. And now, you know, I have to remind you that I'm not a scientist. I'm a journalist, so you know, I'm going to just really give a layman's explanation on what Tesla was working on. But you know, he came up with this idea that he could actually send a resonance wave both through the air and through the earth that that worked like almost like a sine wave, you know, with peaks and valleys. And within those peaks of peaks and valleys, somebody at a different location could put an antenna both, you know, in the air and into the ground, and pick up this this electricity that was being transmitted. Now, Tesla was convinced that this was work based on his experiments, and even went as far as to begin building a huge facility out on Long Island, New York.
Is that where the tower was? I'm trying. Yes. And what there was a name for that? I don't remember what the name of
Wharton Cliff.
Right, there we go.
Yeah, he called it Wharton Cliff, and he got his most of his money was backed by J.P. Morgan.
Right.
And Tesla had told Morgan that this was going to be a wireless facility, like a radio transmitter, where and eventually you'd be able to do, you know, like telephone and even rudimentary video. He neglected to tell Morgan, though, that this facility would also be able to transmit electricity wirelessly. And when Morgan found out about this, he asked Tesla, he says, well, okay, how are we going to meter this? How are we going to make money off of it? And, you know, Tesla said, well, you know, I'll be able to come up with, you know, with ways, but I'm not interested in that right now. And so Morgan withdrew his funds and convinced the Tesla's other backers to do the same. And then, unfortunately, Tesla was never able to finish this tower. So we don't know whether or not it actually would have worked or not. I think it would have worked. Tesla would have never have gone this far. He was not the type of person to go and you know, build something like this if he wasn't convinced it was going to work.
And are we convinced that the journals that disappeared after his death may have contained those secrets?
Some of them, yes. Unfortunately, when Tesla was alive, he had been, you know, robbed a number of times from competitors. Albert Edison was one of them. His patents were often stolen. So when Tesla would have a patent issued, he would neglect to add important details to these patents. I mean, we have his patents and some of his research notes on his wireless transmitting array, but there's missing pages. There's missing material. Some of it has showed up in Belgrade, which the curators at the Tesla Museum will not allow Western reporters, investigators, scientists to look at this stuff.
What has changed since the collapse of the Soviet Union? Has any of this stuff? Have there been any more cooperation on researching any of this, or is it still secret?
Not much. There have been a couple of like documentaries that have been shot where the curators allowed the producers to catch a glimpse of say like the first page from these files, but then that would be it. They would say that they would tell the producers then that they don't have like the proper credentials or anything. Like, nobody from the West seems to have the proper credentials.
It's funny how that works, isn't it?
Yeah, it's like that old war, that old Cold War mentality still exists.
Yeah. Well, it almost seems to be coming back. We I don't know if we can, if we're calling it the Cold War yet, but we certainly are in a similar situation with Russia, despite the fact it's no longer the Soviet Union. One more thing I wanted to touch on, and we only have a couple minutes now to be able to do this, but you wrote about time travel, too. In fact, I think one of your books was actually kind of a how-to, isn't it?
the early version of the book that you referenced at the beginning, Time Travel Fact Not Fiction, was called Time Travel, A How-To Guide. And it deals somewhat with some of these stories that have come out of people who were experimenting, say like with radios and things like that, and claim that they then had like time travel experiences. I touch on those stories with my tongue planted firmly in my cheek,
right?
But there's other stories, like time slips and things like that, that I think have a lot more of veracity to them, I look to those really a lot closer, because I think that there does seem to be some kind of natural phenomena, for want of a better term, that seems to almost be a form of time travel.
And in the minute we have left, Tim, what else are you working on now?
Oh, my gosh. Well, I'm always working on something. I'm helping Timothy Green Beckley finish up a book about his experiences in the 70s with people like David Bowie and people like that who were interested in, the occult and psychic phenomena.
And when will, is that something that you're going to be referenced in, or are you just helping him do that work?
Well, I may be referencing it,
I mean, are you a contributing writer to it? I guess was more appropriately the question.
To a certain extent, right? I'm helping Tim, do the formatting
right.
And things like that.
All right, one more time, give folks your website and where else they can follow your work and get a hold of your books.
Sure. Well, all of my books can be found at Amazon.com. My website is conspiracyjournal.com. We put out a weekly email newsletter that you can sign up for it on our website. And, we send it out for free. It's an aggregate of the week's best weird paranormal types of stories from all over the world. And, it's all the strange and weird news that they don't want you to know.
And it's the stuff we love. Tim, thank you so much for being here. It's a fascinating conversation, and we hope that you'll agree to come back at some point.
Oh, my pleasure, JV. Thanks for having me on.
By the way, if you follow me on Facebook, and you should, just go to Facebook, go to JVJ Paranormal or just JV Johnson. You can find it either way. You'll know that I had mentioned earlier on Facebook tonight that I was going to start cooking again, and many have asked what I ended up cooking. Well, don't judge me here, but I'm on a diet, and I needed to cook broccoli in some fashion. So I made a little broccoli casserole thing because I figure, and tell me if my logic is correct here, if you eat broccoli, it doesn't matter what you put on top of it, it's still good for you, right? So the fact that I had it smothered in cheese and breadcrumbs and stuff doesn't take away from the fact that broccoli was a good diet choice, right? That's what I'm going to go with, okay. Tomorrow night, we've got a couple of guests for you. The first hour, John Potash will be with us to talk about his new documentary, Drugs as Weapons Against Us, the CIA War on Musicians and Activists. And then in the second hour of the show, it'll be Rhonda and Dwight Hall talking about their new book called Conversations with Spirits of the Southwest, A Continued Journey into the Paranormal. So we've got a lot going on all week long. Great stuff. Be sure to join us. I'm JV Johnson. Thanks for being here. Beyond Reality Radio will be heard every night this week, as it always is. But don't forget, Friday night is a best of program, and we'll catch you all of those nights. It's Beyond Reality Radio. Thanks for being here.
Beyond Reality Paranormal is hosted by JV Johnson and produced by Orion Palmer and Slick Eddie Edwards. Like us on Facebook and subscribe to our YouTube channel. Please consider supporting the program either through your podcast platform, click on the link in the description, or on Patreon at Joha Productions. If you'd like to be a guest on Beyond Reality Paranormal, or you have a recommendation for a guest, contact our producer, Slick Eddie Edwards. Eddie is spelled with a Y, at slickeddieedwards@gmail.com.